Somebody called me up and they said, we need some speakers for this big conference. It was the Al-Anon Without Borders. And I said, oh, you need to get Mary Pearl, otherwise known as MERP, is her nickname. And MERP came back to us over the airwaves. MERP, we're so glad to see you. And I was starting to run into a lot of places. I think that first time she had four Al-Anon tech support in the house, buzzing around working the computer so she could talk that first time. And clearly now she's gotten over that and knows how to do it. And we get to talk on the phone every once in a while, especially if she happens to get involved in a car chase or something. She likes to call up and relate that story to me because she knows it would be of interest to me. Please help me welcome my dear friend, Mary Pearl T. from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Thank you, Jack. And thank all of y'all for the invitation to come, and congratulations to all you birthday people. Those birthdays are real important. And my sponsor had 54 years last August, and she was 97, and she passed away last month. It was January. Boy, doesn't time fly. I've noticed with the COVID stuff, does anybody remember what happened last year? Did anything happen last year? It's one of those things. But no, when I came to Al-Anon, there were two people in the group that night, and they had started the meeting 4 months before, didn't know a thing. They had some pamphlets. But God goes ahead and plans in love, and he sent two ladies over to that meeting that night, and they were from the 120 and a half Al-Anon group, which at that time was the oldest group west of the Mississippi, because they were going to have something on their hands. And, you know, they shared their experience, strength, and hope, and that was what gave me an idea that they might know what they were talking about, because they had sort of, I felt like they were talking because they had seen the windows of my soul. So I kept coming back. And, you know, I get tickled today when you hear people bitching about 90 meetings in 90 days. Nobody told me it was like that. I mean, I went for 2 years and didn't miss them. Why didn't somebody tell me it was only 90 meetings in 90 days? Because I loved it. I loved the meetings, the open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they were laughing. They were having fun. Not so much in the Al-Anon rooms. You know, these were where the little thin-lipped, blue-haired, cookie-baking bitches were. And I didn't feel like I fit in there. But I sure did. Like I tried really hard to get into AA, but they just, you know, there's that requirement. And I just didn't have a desire to quit. So I didn't have a desire to start. So if you don't have a desire to start, you don't have to have one to quit. But anyway, I got a sponsor, and because people in AA had a sponsor. There were a few in Al-Anon. My sponsor was Arbutus. And her sponsor was Marguerite. And her sponsor was Lois, Bill Wilson's wife. So we come from good stock, Jack. We come from good stock. Everybody knows how I got here. You know, I got here because I tried to commit murder. Well, I did commit murder, but then I resuscitated him. So you get a little extra points for that. But I want to talk more tonight about the recovery than about the drinking, because that's what's important to me today. You see, I came in January of 1977. That was 45 years ago. And it has changed so much since then. And I am so grateful for all the literature and the meetings and stuff. And yes, I quit doing the circuit because I can't walk. If you can't walk, you don't stand very well. And I can't go up and down steps or anything. So I figured, you know, hey, it's time to move on and give it to the younger ones. But I can't help but be a little grateful for Zoom, because it put me back in touch with my people. And for those of you who go to Zoom meetings and put up a black square with your name in it, what are you doing here? I mean, this is the best face-to-face we've had for 2 years. You know, you can't see a face with a mask. And so I said, I love it. And I don't like talking to a black square. You see me, I want to see you. That's where we get the recovery, is the eye-to-eye contact that we have in Al-Anon. I want to see that you know what I'm talking about. That's really important. And Jack will tell you, as a speaker, when y'all are with me, it makes me better. You know, because when you can feel that y'all are following me, you understand what I'm saying, it just makes this deal a whole lot easier. And if you think it's easy to be a speaker on Zoom, go and stand on next to the wall and put your nose against the wall and tell your story, because you don't get any live feedback, you know. And so you miss that if you've done it for years like we have. Anyway, I got me a sponsor and I started doing what she said. And that was real unusual for me because I'm a know-it-all. And so I don't follow directions too well from other people. But my way hadn't worked. If it had worked, I wouldn't have been here. You know, I always get tickled when people come to Al-Anon and they say, well, that won't work because, and I said, well, look at it this way. You came here. I didn't ask for you to come here. You know, and if you do what we do, you'll get what we got. Now, if you don't want that, then go ahead and do it your own way. Because I came from the school of you do what your sponsor says. You know, and they say, well, it's a program of attraction, Well, I can't even get it out. Anyway, y'all know what I'm trying to say. And if I could have done it, I would have. But I couldn't, so I had to have help. And I had the best help in the world. I had the same sponsor for 45 years. I was very, very blessed to have that sponsor. And I'm a student of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I came in the time when there were the giants in the fellowship, the giants. And I learned so much, and had such sweet memories of so many people, like your sponsor, really, Bob. I knew Bob for years, and wonderful, wonderful people. Anyway, as you can see, I'm getting old. My mind wanders. My sponsor told me to go to as many meetings as I could so I could go every day. And so I went every day, and I learned so much. And I learned a lot in the open AA meetings. I first learned that what my husband was saying sometimes was the truth, because when they would get up at the podium and tell their stories, and I could see some of the things that my husband had said, I'd say, did you feel like that? Did you do this? And he'd say yes. And that helped me to have compassion for the alcoholic. Up to that time, I had none. Now, I had been raised by the most untreated Al-Anon candidate could be, with my mother. Her mother, father, two brothers, two sisters were drunks. And so she ran away from home at 13 to get away from him because my grandfather tried to rape her. So she lived on the streets. And this was the early 1900s. See, my mother was born in 1900. And my daddy was the head of the Army recruiting office in Memphis, Tennessee. And there was a boarding house that he took his meals at. And my mother went to work in that boarding house for her room and board. And that's where they met. And when she turned 16, they got married. So my mother had not been raised with a lot of love and compassion and a lot of nice things in life. But see, I didn't know any of that. All I knew was my mother was, she couldn't have fun. She just could not. She could not. And she, if you were having some, she would put an end to it. And my daddy had retired by the time I was born. I was a change of life baby, and the closest sibling was 16 years older than me. And so my brother was married when I was 4. My sister was married when I was 8. But daddy, he retired from the military, from the Army, and he wanted to fish and hunt and raise bird dogs and train them. And that's what we did. And I was my daddy's shadow. I loved my daddy. We laughed. We had fun. He would answer all my questions. And then there was her. And I would say something and she'd say, shut up, go away. Can't you see I'm busy? Well, I want to tell you a little story about how I learned about me. When I was doing a fourth and fifth step, that's where I began to learn about me. And I can give you a hint. The closer you get to your higher power, the more you will know you, because that's the one that created you. So if you want to know about you, you check in with your higher power and he's going to show you all about you. And I was writing down an experience that I had in my childhood. Daddy and I had gone fishing and she decided to ruin the trip and she came with us. And so she had rules. She had lots of rules for everything. And her rules for fishing were she gets to catch the first fish, the biggest fish, and the most fish. Other than that, you can fish. Well, I made the mistake and I caught the first fish. Well, she looked at it, ripped it off my hook, threw it in and said, it's not a keeper. Well, I'm 5 years old. If it's got eyes and a tail, string it. And no, she wouldn't do that. And so I went into a screaming coma. And Daddy told me, he said, honey, come here in the back end of the boat with me. And as I got close to him, he said, and we'll get her. I didn't know what it meant, but it sounded good. And what it meant was every time she'd catch a fish, she'd swing around, he'd take it off her hook, he'd rebait her hook, she'd swing back around to fish some more, and he'd give me the fish, and I'd put it over the side of the boat. Every fish the old heifer caught. Now, Daddy was playing a joke on Mother, but that's not what I got. What I got that day was, I believe in revenge. Slow, premeditated revenge is the best in the world. Anybody hurts you, get them back as many times as you can. That's what Mary Pearl learned that day at the age of 5. And I didn't realize that's where that revenge came in until I was doing that. You see, I was writing down my best childhood memory. And that was my best childhood memory. So over the years, I have learned a lot about me. And like I say, because Daddy was my everything, Daddy was an old man when I was born. He was 54 years old, which I considered old then. My husband's 86. He does not consider 56 old by any means. And Daddy died when I was 12 years old. And my world ended. And I mean my world ended, because I had been taught about God and about a loving God. And I knew it was all a lie. Because if God loved me, really loved me, he would have taken her, not my daddy. And so I was going to turn my back on any kind of spiritual input into my life from that point until I got into Al-Anon many years later. They had an air base at Little Rock, and there was an article in the paper that said there was at least 10 men for every woman in the county. And I thought, I want my 10. And I want your 10, because see, there's never too much of a good thing. If it feels good, do it till you die on the spot. And so I went trolling and I found this little Yankee boy. Well, he never knew what hit him. Now, I know today that it was not going to work, because it didn't. But you see, if you don't like turnip greens, cornbread and grits, you're just not going to make it here in this house. It's just not going to happen. And he didn't even know what those things were. He was from Pennsylvania. Anyway, he got married, and I thought, he's going to do what I want him to do, and that was take me away from her. I wanted to get away from home, and in those days, kids didn't just go out. You either got married or you went away to college, and she didn't want me to leave home, so I couldn't go, and I needed some help. And so this little boy, he took me away from home. He took me further than I asked to go, actually, because, see, he took me to Newfoundland. And that's where I went, was to Newfoundland. But I have been to Saskatoon. It was 100 below zero there. It's cold there too. But in Newfoundland, it was real cold, but we got between 190 and 210 inches of snow a year. So we had snow most of the time. The worst thing about Newfoundland, it was boring. You see, I'm addicted. My drug of choice is adrenaline. I love excitement. That's the reason I love the alcoholics. There's nothing more exciting than an alcoholic. You never know what the hell they're going to do. I mean, it's just wonderful until you marry it. And somehow it happens that when you marry them and you get that piece of paper and it says they belong to you, it's different. It all changes with a piece of paper. Well, anyway, I was married to this man, and we were in Newfoundland for 5 years. I'm not going to go into all of that, but I knew that I wanted out of that marriage. I wanted out of that relationship, but I'm pretty mercenary, and I didn't want to lose the allotment check. And so we got stationed back at Little Rock through some managing controlling on my part, and it was a mix-up. I called the SAC assignment section and told them I wanted to go back to Little Rock. I didn't even ask him where he wanted to go. It was not important what he wanted. It was all about me. And that's another thing I learned in that inventory, that everywhere I go, there I am. It's always all about me. And so I told him I wanted to go to Little Rock. And they said, no, your next assignment is going to be Minot, North Dakota. I said, Minot? I've been in ice and snow for 5 years. I am not going to Minot. So the sergeant down there says, well, where do you want to go? I said, I want to go back home. Now, this was a place I couldn't wait to get away from, but I knew it was going to be all different now, don't you know? But I didn't know that everywhere I went, there I was. So anyway, I gave him a case of Chevys, and we got to Little Rock. Now, what he did was he changed my husband's career field. He was an aircraft mechanic, and overnight he became the head of a missile inspection team. He'd never seen a missile. A lot of funny things happened in the military, but I knew that they'd get it straightened out. And when they did, they told him that he was going to be moving to Kansas, to Wichita, Kansas. And I said, oh, I'm not going to the tornado capital of the world. It is not happening. It wasn't going to happen anyway, because I just wanted to get rid of him. I wanted to be free. I wanted to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. I didn't want to have to mess with anybody. I just wanted that monthly check coming in. I could do as I pleased or not do as I pleased. And so when I waved goodbye to him, I said to myself, I'm not going to live with you anymore. And so I didn't. Well, after a few weeks, I got bored. Now, that's when I began to look around the neighborhood. You see, I had gone to Newfoundland in the early 60s. Now, the hippie age was coming in, and everybody was doing all this, and I didn't get to do that. I was in Newfoundland, and so I wanted to, and so I looked around my neighborhood, and we had some really neat people in the neighborhood. Some of them were sniffing the little white stuff, and they were growing the marijuana in the backyard, and all this kind of stuff, and I had missed all that, you know? And so I noticed there was a neighborhood softball team, and I thought, I want to join. And so I got me some hot pants and some stretch boots, and I joined that team. And after the game, we'd come back over to everybody's house, and we'd talk about the game. Well, some of them were drinking, and some of them were doing the drug stuff, and I was always afraid of the drugs. People acted weird, a lot more weird on the drugs than they did the alcohol. It was more predictable. And I knew when I'd had too much. When I began to feel it, that's when you quit. And that's that always makes the alcoholic sick, I know, but that's just the way it is. Because I don't like losing control. And so one night they were all over at my house, and this young kid got drunk at my house. And he was only 18, but you had to be 21 to drink in Arkansas, and I didn't want him getting picked up by the sheriff on the way home, so I offered to drive him home in his pickup, and I had them follow me to come back. Well, in the pickup, there was a little box in the front seat, and in that box was a China tea set, and I said, what are you doing with this? He said, it's for my mom for Mother's Day, and I said, oh, okay, and I thought, he'll probably trip and break that because he's walking like rickrack. And so I will be helpful. We're always being helpful. Have you ever noticed that people don't have to ask us for help? We are ever ready to volunteer. And so I volunteered to carry in this China tea set. So here's the picture. It's around 2 or 3 in the morning. I'm going into a house I've never been to before in my life. I am escorting a drunken 18-year-old kid, and I'm carrying a China tea set, your everyday situation. And when he walked in the door there in the bed in his bedroom, he flipped on the light, and there's a man laying on the bed in just his jockey shorts. And he looks up and he says, well, hot damn, little brother, you brought us abroad home. And I said, well, not tonight, fella. Well, that's who's sitting in the chair over here that I've been married to 52 years. And people say, well, where did y'all meet? Well, Now, you know, in normal situations, you just say, well, we just met a long time ago. But y'all understand, in AA and Al-Anon, we understand these little strange meetings that we have. And, you know, there's a time to tell things. And if you go past the time to tell, there's no good time to tell. And 4 years of our dating, and he didn't get drunk that much, maybe once or twice a year. It wasn't a big deal. And but he did ruin our relationship because he asked me to marry him. Because, you see, I have neglected to mention to him that I said, I can't marry you. And he said, well, don't you love me? I said, it has nothing to do with it. I'm married. He said, you're married? And I said, yes, I had forgot to tell him that because, see, I forgot I was married. I have that kind of memory. You know, I can just block it out, go away. It doesn't matter. And so then that meant I had to get a divorce. I was going to lose my allotment check. I had to think about that for a while. And I was going to have to go to work. And but I was in love. And so all of a sudden, guess what? Alcoholism moved into my house. We were not living together like they do nowadays. You know, they do all that nowadays, but we didn't. And he moved into the house. Now, this was the 7th of November. Thanksgiving came around. We had company. And first thing he always said was, what would y'all like to drink? I go into the bar. I'm going to mix the drinks. We don't have any alcohol. Now, prior to my marriage, I had a fully stocked bar. What happened? I have a poodle and a German shepherd. They're not drinking much. But now here's the denial already coming into my life. And he helped me look for it. Don't you love the alcoholic? They're so inventive, you know. And we kept trying to figure out the house hadn't been broken into, this, that, and just, oh, well, what the hell, go get some more and bring it back. I mean, that was the solution. And you don't think about it. Because if you think about it, it'll make sense as to what happened. And when you don't want the truth to be true, you don't think about it. You just block it off. That's that denial. It's, you know, it may be hell, but it's not hot and I'm not here. You know, that's just the way it is. Well, he would disappear. And that went on and on until I couldn't stand it. And he, there was also that situation with the other women. You know, he had drinking companions and I knew what they were. I'd been one. I knew what that was about. And so I thought, no, don't want that. And then one night he came home and he brought one with him. And he said, she doesn't have a place to stay tonight. And I said, guess what? You don't either. You know, those kind of things, you know, just happen in alcoholism. They don't happen in a lot of other diseases. I've never heard of anybody throwing their husband out with cancer, but you'll throw him out for alcohol in a heartbeat. And anyway, JD went to the doctor and told the doctor he might have a slight drinking problem. And he told us about Alcoholics Anonymous and gave us the phone number. But JD said, I'm not an alcoholic. I said, that's right, he's not. Because see, I knew what an alcoholic was. That was my grandfather, my grandmother, those aunts and uncles. And we just stayed away from him. He wasn't going to be like them. I wasn't going to let that happen. He was not going to be an alcoholic. Well, that's the year that he didn't drink, and I went completely off the rails. I began to think about how miserable I was and how I couldn't stand the life I was living, and he was the problem. I realized it wasn't the alcohol because he wasn't drinking. And see, violence had entered our home a long time before. I was raised by a mother who was violent, and so I knew what abuse was about. But that's just the way you were brought up. And people who are abused a lot of times become abusive because that's a norm for you. And so I had put injury upon him upon occasion. And I began to think, and see, that's what it, when I have somebody I'm sponsoring, they tell me I've been thinking, I get cold chills and the hair raises on your arms. Because, you know, that's the one thing you don't do by yourself is think. And so I had a whole committee that I thought with. And we were sitting there talking, and it was like, you know, I'm miserable. I am too. Well, why don't we get a divorce? We can't get a divorce. Well, why can't you get a divorce? Well, you've already had one divorce. If you have to keep getting divorces, what's the common denominator? We're not going there. And so I would move on. And then one night it came up, and it was like, okay, I'm so miserable. Here we are again. And well, you know, if he were to die, what was that? Well, if he were to die, you could be a widow. Now, that sounds good because see, there'd be insurance and all that other stuff. Okay, sounds good. And so it's like, but he's not dying. Well, we can take care of that. And just that simple, I began to plot murder. Just that simple. And then I read in the paper where a woman had killed her husband, said he was an alcoholic, and they put her in jail. Can you believe that? It wouldn't have happened if I'd have been on that jury. I can guarantee you it would not have happened. But anyway, so now I've got to go back and have another meeting with the committee. And so we're thinking about it that fall, about what to do. And it take away some of my favorite, like, you know, stabbing him with an ice pick in the neck and watching him drip. That was my favorite way. And so now we got to come up with a way where we won't have to go to jail. And then it occurred to me, an alcoholic were to drown in the bathtub, who would know? Who would know? It sounded perfect. It was a group conscience. We all liked it. And so then you just wait, because you know the time will come. And the time did come when he got drunk. And when he came home, I took one look at him and I hit him as hard as I could. And he fell and hit the coffee table and knocked himself out. And I drug him across the floor into our bathroom. I ran the bathtub full of warm water and I put him in and held him until the bubbles quit coming. Now, when I was in Newfoundland, I worked for the Red Cross. But a voice came in my head that was not a member of my committee, and it said, look what you're doing. You can't do this. And I said, picked him up by the hair of the head, and I said, the hell I can't. And I put him back down again. And the voice came back, and it said, don't you realize you're committing murder? You're taking the life you someone once loved. And I thought, no, this is justifiable homicide. And the voice said, no, this is premeditated murder. And it scared me to death. If you'd have told me I had been capable of that, I would have told you are out of your mind. But I was out of mine. And so I thank God I had worked for the Red Cross, and I jerked him out and I resuscitated him. I put him in the bed, and I even got the hair dryer down, dried his hair because I didn't want him to catch cold. And then I went in my living room and I rocked for hours. I rocked for hours, and I was desperate. Desperation, you know, that's a gift, G-O-D, the gift of desperation. And I was desperate, but I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to do anything different. So what do? You don't know. So you do what you've always done. You justify and rationalize. If he hadn't got drunk, I wouldn't have had to do it. It's not my fault. And I went on and went to work. Well, he wasn't doing real well. And it took him 2 or 3 days to be able to get out of the room. And I came home from work and he said, would you call this number for me? I've been trying to get it. We had push button phones and he was shaking so bad. He couldn't get the right number. He was trying to call Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called him and they said, there's a meeting in 1 hour's time, 6 blocks from your house. And it was a building that was built by my grandfather who died of wet brain from alcoholism. And it was a community building. He was a mason. And so he had done all the rock work on that building. And we went over there. I took him to his first meeting. And those two ladies came over and said, we have Alan on, it's for you. And I said, there's nothing wrong with me. Now, I just tried to commit murder a few days before, but there's nothing wrong with me. Isn't that denial a wonderful thing? Anyway, so like I say, that's how I got here. Well, I had to make changes and I had no higher power. And my sponsor helped me. You know, I would ask her to pray for me because I didn't know how to pray. And I didn't know God. And I would tell her, God loves you. He'll do it for you. She said, he'll do it for you. I said, no, I'm bad. I'm not good like you are. Because see, I knew of all the things that I had done, that I wrecked my marriage in Newfoundland, and I came back here and the abuse and the violence and everything. I said, no. And so she says, well, I'll loan you my God, but I will pray for you. And I always felt that if God did anything, he was doing it for Lubell. He wasn't doing it for me. And then she told me one night there was a convention going to be there in Hot Springs. And she said, why don't you and JD go to that convention? I said, he got sober. He got fired. It was a wonderful thing. I was so thrilled. And so now I've got the whole financial responsibility on me. And I said, we're not even able to pay all of our bills right now. And I said, and to go to a convention? Because see, I'm thinking like a business convention, lots of books and stuff. And she said, well, just pray about it. And I said, I don't know how. She said, just ask God. And so I went home and I was talking to JD and he said, well, his sponsor had said the same thing. And I said, you want to pray together about it? He said, do I have to say anything? I said, not a word. And so we knelt together by the side of the bed and we held hands and we prayed our first prayer together. that we have continued to this day. That praying together is very powerful. I got up the next morning, I went to work, and I called and made reservations at that hotel in Hot Springs. 30 minutes later, JD, who had been looking for months for a job, called and said, I have a job. And we saved our money, and because we wanted to go, and I couldn't pay bills. I couldn't go to the convention on bill money. That would not have been right. So I had to go above and beyond and save and really scrimp. And I figured if I ate cheese and crackers in the room and just had the registration and the room, this would be what we would go. And we'd do that, make that sacrifice. And it occurred to me he didn't have anything to wear, because this is the days of polyester and the leisure suits. And JD smoked. And when you smoked and you drank, the ashes went all over you. So he'd look like a colander, because that stuff would melt. You know, he had all these holes all over him. And I said, good Lord, you can't go that way. And I got a brochure in the mail from Chicago, a mail order place, and they had a closeout on suits. You got two pairs of pants, a reversible vest, and a jacket for $49.95. I said, it can't be much. But we didn't have anything, so we ordered it. And when the week came for the convention, we were $35 short. $35 short. And see, that miracle that God gave us, him having a job and all, you don't get too many of those. And so I told him, I said, I'm going to have to call and cancel because we're $35 short. And that night the UPS brought the pants and the suit. And he said, well, I want to try it on. I said, try it on. And he looked so nice in it. And he said, there's something wadded up in the pocket. He pulled out a 20, a 10, and a 5. And we looked at each other and said, I would never have thought to tell God to put it there in a suit that had been altered to fit him. Came in the mail with that 35, and we went to the convention. And, you know, the love of the people at Al-Anon and AA is unparalleled. Because they knew we were struggling, and they were trying every meal somebody invited us out to eat. And came the night for the big banquet and all the speakers, and we were going to have to sit in our room and watch it on closed circuit TV. But we wanted so much to be a part of it. We couldn't afford banquet tickets. Good God, if we were going to eat cheese and crackers, you know. And so I looked, JD says, what's that in the floor? And I said, I don't know. And there was an envelope laying over by the door, and there were two banquet tickets. And they were the tickets where the table, where the speakers were. And here we were at our first convention, and we got to sit with all the speakers. And it was a big lineup. It was Jim W. from Texas. And I mean, there was just John, the Indian from Boston or New Boston, Mass. I mean, it was the thrill of a lifetime to get to do something like that. And we didn't even know who they were. But we had heard them talk, you know, and we were just thrilled, and we fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I suggest that you do, is fall in love with the program of recovery. It's more than the fellowship. The fellowship is fine. The slogans will give you something to hang on to. I call them the handrails to the steps. But the program of recovery is listed in the big book. It's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they tell you exactly. How to do it. And the AA 12 and 12, there wasn't an Al-Anon one. And so we use the AA 12 and 12 to this day. And we have a big book study every Monday night. I started it in January of 1989, and we moved to Zoom in the March of 2020. And we're keeping it going. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's experiences from the Al-Anon perspective. So if you would like to join us sometime, and I feel that my time is out, and I want to thank you for having invited me. I love this program. I love Al-Anon, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. If you think it didn't break my heart to say goodbye in Nashville in 2012, it absolutely broke my heart. But I have gave my program new life when the Zoom came. Because I didn't realize how much I had missed seeing all of y'all and being with you. So I thank God for that. You see, my life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but he worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget he sees the top while I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly will God unroll that canvas and explain the reasons why. But those dark threads are as needful in the skillful weaver's hand is the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you.